House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It is 3:15 on March 11th. With us, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto, and Vice Chair Hughes, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. We have two items on the calendar today. The first one up would be House Bill 67, product warranties and required updates. Second will be House Bill 123, establishing the Marijuana Control Board. Representative Hucker and Julie Leckie, please come up. We'll save one of you a trip.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to be here with you. I'm Representative Mike Hawker, District 28 in Anchorage. And if it indulges the chair, pleases the chair and indulges the committee, I would like to give a brief overview of what our bill is, and then Ms. Leckie would be very happy to go over in any level of detail and granularity concerns the committee might have. So, Mr. Chairman, we are presenting House Bill 67. House Bill 67 was a concept and concern that was brought to my attention by constituents in my office, or excuse me, constituents in my district, who own retail construction equipment companies. And in operating their retail construction equipment company, they have identified some concerns with fixing the need in the state of Alaska to perhaps clarify and better delineate the responsibility for performing warranty work, warranties that arguably come from the manufacturer, then through the vendor, and ultimately protect the consumer in the state. And there certainly is, with the lack of clarity, there are concerns by our retail vendors in the state that financial obligations that really belong to the manufacturer are being coercively pushed down upon our local vendors. We'd like to start, Mr.
Excuse me for one moment. We've been joined by Representative Culver, so we have a full committee.
And thank you again, Mr. Chairman. You know, the statute that we have brought before you today, House Bill 67, was based on and modeled on our current statute that regards boats and recreational vehicles. This is a warranty statute that this legislature passed within recent memory. I can't put my date on it, but they had the same issues, but was focused on, again, boats and recreational vehicles. This one goes to construction equipment. The bill itself defines the relationship and responsibilities between manufacturers and the vendors of equipment, tools, and off-road vehicles that are used in construction, resource extraction, development, snow removal, forestry, and similar functions. Within the bill are some carefully crafted delineations there. The bill simply ensures that our Alaska dealers are sufficiently and appropriately reimbursed for work and expenses they incur on behalf of a manufacturer of certain equipment. I would like to put this very clearly on the record, and I'll probably say it twice just to be sure it's on the record, is that this bill does not apply to motor vehicles registered for highway use. This is a very important distinction, as automobile passenger truck automobiles, other vehicles that are registered for highway use are in a separate class. That is not what this bill applies to. The bill limits itself to warranty work on defective products and upgrades on those products. The bill substantively sets a minimum reimbursement rate for parts and labor. It requires the manufacturer to send necessary parts that a dealer or distributor doesn't possess, and it sets deadlines for approval and payment of claims, and clearly delineates which party is responsible for what. That is the manufacturer, the person who manufactured the product, and the vendor who simply is vending the product in a relationship with the manufacturer. Note that 36 states have enacted similar laws and really consider it the commercial protection laws regarding warranty work performed by dealers, distributors, for manufacturers. And House Bill 67 also includes a provision that extends our state's, in quotes, lemon law provisions, which currently exist for the boats, ATVs, snow machines, and new motor vehicles to the products covered in this bill. Noting this does not change the law with regards to motor vehicles or otherwise. It simply extends that umbrella of protections for inherently defective products, lemon product. We've all heard the colloquialism, that car was a real lemon. And I'm sure no Alaska car dealer would ever sell a car that was a real lemon, but we've heard the term mentioned probably with regards to cars sold in California or someplace. But that we extend the lemon law provisions in our statutes to equipment, a major part of our economy. Now, you will hear certainly testimony that the major manufacturers in the country object to this legislation. And respectfully understand, why wouldn't they object? Because we are, in fact, preventing those manufacturers from dictatorially exercising what I would consider undue influence and economic hardship on their independent vendors here in the state of Alaska. And again, particularly with regards to our heavy equipment industry, this is an industry that many Alaskans and we as our economy depend upon to support our resource base and development thereof. So I think this is one of those cases where with the evolution and growth of state warranty protection laws, warranty clarification laws, where it's been in effect for automobiles, passenger vehicles, registered motor vehicles have their own set of statute. We did expand warranty protections to boats and recreational vehicles here a few years ago. I think it's time for us to give a very serious consideration to the concerns of our equipment vendors in the state of Alaska and see what we can do to protect them from, I think, coercive practices by very large national manufacturers who really, you know, almost have a monopolistic control over the nature of the equipment sold here. So, Mr. Chair, that is the bill in a nutshell. We'd be happy to provide any detailed, granular discussion of the specific components of the bill as your committee would will, sir.
Representative Joseph, you look like you have a question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hawker, although the focus is industrial and heavy equipment, this could apply to a stereo?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, to these granular details, if it pleases the committee, I would prefer to have my aide Julie Lucky respond, who is intimately familiar with these granular concerns.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Josephson, for the record, my name is Julie Lucky, staffer, Representative Mike Hawker, and I might suggest that we adopt the CS first, as one of the changes in the CS was to narrow the items that were covered by the bill, and it might be better to discuss that definition as opposed to the original bill, which didn't really put any sidebars on the products that were covered.
For those of you that don't know, Ms. Lucky, she's telepathic. That was the next thing up. So I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS at this point in time.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move CSHB 67 version /E.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. And Representative Culver, did you have a question for the sponsor of the bill or for Ms. Lucky?
Whoever wants to answer it. In the letter of support, Representative Hawker, there's one from a machinery dealer that talks about a situation where there's a flat fee paid for to make a repair in the field and how that would cause an undue hardship in Alaska. Could you point us out to the section that would cure that in this bill that would allow for a reasonable charge for performing that warranty work?
Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Representative Culver, I would be delighted to, and again, if you would permit me the indulgence of having my aide, who is more intimately familiar with the specific provisions of the bill, to respond to your question.
I guess it's time to start with Julie. Thanks for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got our undivided attention as long as you need it.
Right. My name is Julie Lucky, staffer, Representative Mike Hawker, and Specifically, what the bill does, and I can, if we go to the, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to speak to the changes in the CS just so it's very clear which version we're moving off of? All right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Colbert, there is no minimum time or reasonable time of work in the bill. What we do is we do set a minimum labor rate in the bill, and we do clarify that there must be a certain amount of time for administrative work. The labor rate is covered in version E under the 4545777, which is page 2, starting on line 28. And it continues through page 3, and it states that the manufacturer shall pay the dealer or distributor providing the service a rate that is not less than the highest of the following for labor of the technicians. And so they have the choice, well, not really the choice, I mean they would have to choose a rate that is at least as high as one of those three rates, whichever is the highest. We do also require payment for cleanup, preparation, diagnosis, disassembly, repair, assembly, testing, and final cleaning as needed to provide a quality result. So it doesn't necessarily specify a minimum amount of time, but it says that the time must be adequate to perform all of these services. In addition, there is an hour for administrative services that is required on subsection D, which starts on page 3, line 13.
Representative Ledeau.
Yeah. I can see where you're coming from in this bill, but I guess I wonder what is the rationale for interfering with people's right to contract. I mean, it's always kind of easy to say, you know, this is the little guy, and there's this big bad corporation out there that's going to do really mean, awful things to the little guy, so, like, let's change the law. And, I mean, I guess I can see lots of situations there. Once upon a time, I lived on an island. I mean, prices there on the island were just sort of higher because there wasn't all that much competition. But we didn't set rent controls or price controls or things like that because we kind of thought that in the end maybe the free market system worked. Why isn't the free market system working here?
Through the chair, Representative Olson to Representative Ledeau, I'm sure you're very familiar with the five elements that are required legally for a valid contract. And one of those five elements is the absence of any form of duress on one of the contracting parties. Duress is a very broad subject, has been examined extensively in the legal system, and there are certainly levels of what might be constituted duress, and in relation to a contracting entity, it is when is one of the parties in such a position that the other party is unable to fairly negotiate the terms of an agreement, where in fact one party is dictating to the other party the terms of an agreement. And that's essentially what we have in these vendor-manufacturer relationships. When we have a mega company in this country that is the manufacturer of a particular line or type of product, construction equipment, and I'm going to refrain from using any name, but any one of the major national, international manufacturers who then, in order to have their product sold in Alaska, dictates the terms of their franchise agreements with their vendors in the state of Alaska. Those franchisees really don't have any choice but to say, yes, it's not really a negotiable item because of the extreme weight and influence and ability of the one party to the contract. So it's not a contract that's negotiated at an arm's length among parties of equal standing, as you will understand, that the two parties do not have equal standing in that negotiation. That's where we delicately, within the framework of Alaska law, want to provide guidelines for those contracts that can keep them sort of within sidebars. And that's exactly what this bill does. And with this bill, we've crafted it and looked at a lot of language used in a lot of different states and have tried to craft it as a bill that provides guidelines and reasonable basis for these relationships between manufacturers and vendors without getting overly prescriptive and not trying to dictate a fixed rate or fixed terms, but rather provide a framework, a rubric of guidelines for the relationship between, to create a fair economic relationship between manufacturers and vendors.
Paula?
Well, how do I have equal standing when I'm trying to get a loan from a bank? I mean, the bank is this big institution, and I'm just a regular person. I mean, but we don't tell the bank, you know, basically, what to charge me.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, respectfully, the banking industry, and particularly in this case, if you're talking about the commercial loan industry or the residential loan industry, or the consumer loan industry, all of those are perhaps some of the most heavily regulated industries in the country when we look at how they are regulated by the tax codes, how they are regulated by usury statutes, how they are regulated by non-discrimination statutes, and a plethora of, in fact, even now we've got those transactions are regulated under FIREA for environmental matters and subsequent protective, in very, very heavily regulated under FIREA, so that any holder of property has always has recourse against the previous holder of property for environmental damage. So I would respectfully suggest that the financial institutions relationship between small individuals and the mega banks is exactly the kind of relationship we're talking about here and exactly why we have all of the financial protection laws at both the state and federal level.
Representative Josephson, I believe I cut you off when I adopted the
No, I don't think
CS.
Yes, Go thank you, Mr. Chen. Representative Hawker or Ms. Lucky, how are disagreements resolved under your bill between the manufacturer and the ultimate purchaser?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Josephson, I believe that we have from the AG's office, Ed Sniffen, who can talk more about the process. When we crafted this bill, we based it on current law regarding the ATV, snow machines, and boats in order to have that kind of track record of the whatever disagreements we might have had ahead of time. And I believe that he can talk a little bit more about how, in practice, those are mediated or resolved.
And pending that, I have one other question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also curious about the issue of electronic notice to the manufacturer from the vendor when there's a defect or need for repair. Is that something that could reasonably be added, or what is your position on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Josephson, I believe that you are asking about the certified mail requirement for the Lemon Law provisions. And again, Mr. Sniffen might be in a better position to discuss this issue. We did ask after your staff had inquired about the electronic service versus certified mail. The certified mail requirement exists in all of our Lemon Law provisions. We have Lemon Law provisions for various things in current statute. And what I was told by Department of Law was that it does provide a proof of mailing and a proof of receipt, where we don't necessarily have a standard for proof of mailing of email and proof of receipt. So therefore, the aggrieved party in this case could send an email and say, well, obviously I sent it on this date. Here's my email with the date stamped on it. And the manufacturer could say, well, we never received that email. And where there's no real proof that that was received, that I mean, that's basically the definition, or the reason I was given by our Department of Law is right now there's no standard of proof of I have gotten this and I have received it, and certified mail is the standard that they use.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello?
No.
Would you like that stuff an hour? Do you want to continue or?
Mr. Chairman, it is the pleasure of the committee how you would like to proceed.
We've heard Ed's name mentioned three times. Ed, are you with us? Ed? Got a green light, but. Well, Julie, please continue. I think Ed is probably on his way back. Ed, are you with us?
Can you, oh, yes, sorry. I was hollering into the microphone here, Mr. Chairman, and the red light wouldn't go off.
Please state your name and affiliation, and welcome back, Ed.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Olson. My name is Ed Sniffen. I'm with the Attorney General's Office in Anchorage. My responsibilities include enforcement of our consumer protection laws, including both our ATV and motor vehicle lemon law statutes. And I've been doing this for about 15 years now, and we have had some situations that might address some of the questions that Representative Josephson had, but I'm here primarily for questions and would be happy to proceed as you direct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ledoux.
And what's usually done when there's an, I mean, I think what Representative Hawker is talking about, when there's a huge disparity between one party and another party to a contract, it's called an adhesion contract. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, that could be one type of a contract. Insurance contracts, for example, are often viewed as contracts of adhesion, because they contain language that one party really understands and knows and the other party does not.
So do the courts or does the state normally substitute their own provisions for those in those type of contracts, or do they simply declare that the contract is null and void and is a way of getting out of the contract?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, contract interpretation can be a little tricky. The courts generally look to the intent of the parties when they are deciding what a contract should or shouldn't provide for. If there is, as you mentioned, a contract of adhesion issue, that's something the courts can take a look at. Our Supreme Court has, gone a bunch of different ways on different types of contracts, but if there is an overly unfair advantage to one of the parties, to the extent that it looked like the consumer, for example, in an insurance agreement just couldn't reasonably have understood the contract, and there was no meeting of the minds, so there couldn't have been a contract, and sometimes those contracts can be voided.
So what's usually done when the consumer, let's say they understand it, but they just don't have any other alternative?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I guess that's why we have lawyers. it's one of those things that if there's a legitimate dispute over the terms of a contract, and it's something that one person understood but disagrees with, if there's a factual dispute or a legal dispute, it's something that the parties can litigate, and either a jury or a judge will decide.
So I gave... Excuse me. You are a lawyer, Mr. Sniffen, aren't you?
That's what they tell me, Representative Ledoux.
Okay.
Yes.
Just wanted to make sure. So I gave the example of the bank, and that was a lousy example. Suppose I'm in a small community, and there's only one grocery store in that community. And that grocery store, because there's only one grocery store, it charges some really, really high prices. Does the state or the court usually get into those things and say to the store, well, we think this price is unreasonable, so you've got to lower the price?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you know, that's an excellent question, and it is something I actually know a little bit about because I also enforce Alaska's antitrust statutes. For example, our situation in Bethel, with the closure of the store there is going to be one store left. That store now has a natural monopoly. They're probably entitled to charge whatever rate they want to charge. The state does not regulate pricing on products, just like we don't regulate the price of gasoline, for example. And suppliers of gasoline and can charge what they can get away with and what people are willing to pay. So where the state gets involved, and maybe this gets to your question a little bit, is if there is some illegal conduct related to that price. For example, if there's predatory pricing conduct, and the store is attempting to engage in some unilateral conduct to force another competitor out, or if the price is set through some collusion with a competitor, for example, so they can artificially raise prices without the benefit of true market competition. So we would look at those kinds of things when reviewing the pricing of someone's product. In this particular case, where we have a let's say an equipment supplier who is entering into a warranty contract with a retailer, I believe what the bill attempts to do is just like the bills for ATV manufacturers and automobile manufacturers have found themselves in a similar situation where they do have so much power over the retailers and the franchisees that they can almost dictate terms of those contracts. And so the statute would provide some mechanism for the vendors to say, look, if you're going to require us to do this kind of service, we want to be at least paid fairly. And, of course, those are all policy decisions. It is something that we've looked at, and it seems like it's good consumer protection, but doesn't seem to be anything inconsistent with this statute that we don't already do with other manufacturers of products like automobiles or ATVs or boats.
Is it inconsistent philosophically that we don't regulate the, assuming that there's no predatory practices, that we don't regulate a store in a monopoly sort of situation, not because there's been anybody doing anything wrong, but just because it's just one store and one community and they can charge whatever they want to charge?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yeah, I understand exactly your question and your concern, and it would be a policy decision to decide to regulate pricing in those kinds of situations.
I believe the sponsor has a comment on that, too, as well,
and
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, and I want to commend Mr. Sniffen for his very accurate characterization of the legislation before us, and I would note that this bill is not about regulating pricing of any kind. And it's not about a transaction that involves, say, bulk commodities, buying groceries from a grocery store, buying gasoline from a fuel distributor, fuel station. This is specifically about the relationship between manufacturers and sellers that involve products that themselves have a certain products that have a product warranty from the manufacturer. I don't think we have, Quaker Oats doesn't put a warranty on oatmeal. That's not what we're going to here. We're not looking at regulating an industry. We're not looking at regulating pricing. We are not looking at, frankly, regulating the terms, the specific terms that are, understandable between the manufacturer and the vendor, but we are putting some sidebars there that are reasonable protections for the vendor in that case where there is a dictatorial opportunity on behalf of the manufacturer. But again, it is only to product warranty issues in that relationship. It is not other issues in the relationship of the vendor to the manufacturer, and it's only goes to product warranty issues, not to anything else.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Sniffen? He will be online for the rest of the meeting, but I'd like to get back to Ms. Lucky if there are no further questions for Ed at this time. Thanks again, Ed. You'll be around?
I am, Representative Olson. Thank you.
Thanks. Ms. Lucky?
Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think we might have gone over most of what the bill does, but I'll try to get through it in order of the bill. Basically, the bill would... It covers both warranty work and what they call required updates, this category of work where the manufacturer wants something done to its product and the dealer provides that work on behalf of the manufacturer. So if a product has a defect from the manufacturer, or possibly the manufacturer later on might decide that they would like to have a modification done for safety reasons or to improve their products, the dealer is on the hook basically for doing that work. That's the body of work that we're covering in the first half of the bill. The second half of the bill is the lemon law provisions, and we'll just go through in order using the e-work draft. It requires the manufacturer to provide the warranty to the dealer and to the dealer to provide the warranty to the ultimate purchaser of the item, that the warranty and the manuals. It requires the dealer or distributor to provide warranty service on behalf of the manufacturer. And the meat of the bill really is in the minimum payments. So the manufacturer is not allowed to restrict the parts, the number of parts, or the type of parts that are used in order to perform this work. The payment for required services must meet a minimum. So we do talk about the minimum labor rates. And the minimum time, even though it doesn't discuss the actual monetary value or the time value, as we discussed a little earlier, there's a minimum of 1 hour for administration of the claim, and there is also a reimbursement for transportation and lodging costs when providing this service in the field. So if you have a product that can't be shipped back to the dealer or distributor at this point, the vendor is bearing that cost of sending a technician maybe out for a day on a flight. That person has to stay overnight because the next flight from this remote location isn't until the next day. The dealer is out, that employee's work for that day, and they feel they're not being reimbursed adequately for those travel and lodging costs that they are incurring. It sets a timeline for the payment of claims, and that specifically is you have 30 days from the claim. The manufacturer has 30 days to either approve or deny the claim. If it is not denied in 30 days, it is deemed approved, and then they have 30 days after the approval in order to pay it. The second section of the bill, which starts on page 4, line 15, are the lemon law provisions. And as was stated earlier, these lemon law provisions are in areas for other items in our statute, including boats, ATVs, snow machines, and motor vehicles. And it basically sets up a framework where if you have tried to get your product fixed a certain number of times, and it has not been fixed, you can send a certified letter, as Representative Josephson pointed out earlier, to the manufacturer stating that despite these reasonable attempts, reasonable number of attempts, your product still is not functional. And then it provides that the manufacturer shall either provide you a new product or reimburse your purchase price minus an amount for the use you've gotten out of the product. There are some exceptions to the lemon law provisions. They're on page 6, lines 9 through 19. And then there is also a rebuttable presumption about a reasonable number of attempts, which is the term of art we use in the law. Responding to Representative Josephson's question earlier, on page 7, lines 2 through 9, we discuss what products are covered in the bill. And it does, and I'll quote from the bill, include equipment, tools, or motor vehicles. If the equipment, tools, or motor vehicles are designed to be primarily used for construction, road building, snow removal, mining, oil projects, gas projects, forestry, resource development, or a similar type of product. And then it clearly exempts motor vehicles that are registered to be used on the highway. So in answer to the question that was asked earlier, the current bill would not include a radio. I understand how you would be the confusion that was in the previous bill, which is one of the reasons that we went to the CS, was there was no real definition of what products were covered.
Representative LeBoux, followed by Representative Tilton.
So are motor vehicles covered under a similar act? Do we have a law on the books that is already doing this as far as automobiles?
Through the chairman, Representative LeBoux, automobiles are covered under a different act. I'm not sure how similar their law is to this law. It is my understanding that the auto dealers are working on some of the details of their warranty provisions, but I believe that's covered, and if I had a statute book, I could give you the actual site, but it's 4545. I think it's the section that comes just directly before the new section we're putting in.
Follow?
So when you say the automobile dealers are working on their warranties, so does that mean that the dealers and the manufacturers are working together in order to come to something that is agreeable to both? I'm not quite following you there.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I am not privy to what the auto dealers are doing. They do have a section in statute that deals with warranty work and the relationship between franchisees and manufacturers that is separate and clearly exempted from this act. It is my understanding their statute is also going through a revision, but I'm not familiar enough with what they are doing. That is just what I've heard from the auto dealers. Their concern was that they were not included in our act because they do have a statute that covers their warranty work and their relationship that is separate from this statute.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Harker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ledoux, I would like to reiterate what Ms. Lucky just said, that I am unaware of any work going on related to the automotive warranty section of Alaska statutes. This statute was developed in its it was developed specifically to stay away from anything to do with the automobile warranties so that they were left in their own silo of statute. This is absolutely specifically related to those equipment care to the qualified equipment that was discussed in section 45.787 for products covered, as was discussed earlier.
Mr. Chairman?
After Representative Tilton and Hughes.
Sure. I'll pass on
my
right
now. Yeah. And actually, I maybe could pass because I just read, thank you for presenting your bill. On page 7, the products covered section, I noticed construction road building, didn't notice road maintenance, which a lot of equipment is used for that. But I do see that you have a phrase or a similar type of project. So you are you confident that that language would cover? Because I'm thinking of, a piece of equipment that might put gravel on the roads or something. So it's not really road building, but there's a lot of big equipment used in road maintenance. And just want to make sure that's covered in here.
And through the chair, Representative Hughes, that is certainly absolutely the intent. You know, without trying to be absolutely delineative here, we talk about equipment, tools, and vehicles designed for construction, road building, snow removal, that type of thing, and says, or similar type of project, and that would certainly imply work as an activity of the project of working. So, you know, very definitely we would include, and with that key exemption, if the piece of equipment is subject to titling and registration for on-road use, this bill does not encompass it.
Representative Tilton, did we skip you?
Nope, I am good right now. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hucker, my sense of this bill is that when commercial or industrial interests are purchasing equipment, the first thing I assume they ask is, what is the period of the warranty? What does it cover? And they probably don't get into the weeds about who pays this surcharge and that surcharge. And those things were just sort of being foisted in the absence of any dialogue on the vendor. Is that what was sort of happening?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that's probably a fairly reasonable definition of it. But what I would almost offer, and Mr. Chair, what I would offer is that since that's really a question not of me as the carrier of a bill, but of those persons affected, it might be a really wonderful question to also ask someone who's testifying on behalf of this bill.
Okay. And just a quick follow-up. What I never fully understand, and maybe there isn't any particular answer, but I'm always curious, what would stop Kubota, for example, from saying, fine, you know, we've got to pick up these administrative costs, and we've got to pay for your maintenance and your drive out to Tope and all the rest, and so our backhoe is now $55,000, not $50,000. I've never really understood what stops anyone from doing that. Is there something you know of?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, when you mentioned Kibata, I was wondering, what did a bridge have to do with this?
No, but Kubota.
Kubota,
yes.
Yes, and Kubota's, of course, a major, I believe they are the Korean or Japanese equipment manufacturer. But I think the answer to that question, because that is where competition exists in the marketplace, because if Kubota raises the price of its skid loader 15%, John Deere doesn't, or Caterpillar doesn't, or you know, Mitsubishi doesn't, you know, go down the list, but I think that's really where market forces come into play.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So other than that there might be some similar language with respect to motor vehicles, which we're not quite sure of, why wouldn't motor vehicles be included in this? I mean, I guess I would think that all of the same problems would be applicable.
You want to take a spin at that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, I think the reason that we crafted this bill to not include the auto dealers was, the first and foremost, was that this was not a problem that our constituents that came with us. I mean, oftentimes legislators bring bills at request of constituents, and as we were working through this bill, this is what our constituents needed. We did not hear from auto dealers with a hue and cry saying, we're having some problems getting reimbursed for our warranty work, and therefore we would like the legislature to come with protections. There was obviously a similar effort in 2009 with the boats and ATVs and snow machines, and I guess the same question could be asked of, you know, why would that bill have not had the auto dealers and also these particular products that we're trying to include in that protection today? When we crafted this bill, we were very careful because the auto dealers already have statute. We didn't want to then go through and basically rewrite their entire statute when the problem that was being experienced by our constituents was limited to off-road motor vehicles. I believe that would be a policy call for this, you know, for the legislature and the committee to discuss. But from our perspective, you know, our constituents had a particular problem. We tried to address their particular problem in this particular bill, and the auto dealers have not asked us to be included in these provisions. In fact, we have heard the opposite from the auto dealers in the state, that they would prefer to be covered in their own statute because they do have other issues that they would like to have addressed.
And through the chair, I'd like to just reemphasize that we are looking at a very different and unique market segment rather than the commercial motor vehicle, the highway motor vehicle industry that already does have, as Ms. Lucky said, a functioning statute in place. This was really looking at a gap in our statutory protections for our commercial community.
You know, I might add that going back to the 2009, I think that set up the firewall between the automobile industry and the off-road vehicles and equipment on the boats. And I think, as I recall, it was a long and drawn-out process, and I think that's why we're not having the issue that we have with it, is because it's already been taken care of. I don't think we're going to ask about the fiscal note, Julie. It looks like it's all goose eggs.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can confirm that it is zero fiscal note.
Any further questions for the sponsor or the his able-bodied assistant? Well, seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, the CS is adopted, and I think we're going to open it up to public testimony at this point in time. Public testimony is now open online. We've got Chad John Date.
Jermaine.
Well, close enough. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and please weigh in on this.
My name is Chad Gerondale. I work for Construction Machinery Industrial. I have worked in the construction equipment industry for 28 years. I've worked on the dealer side as well as for the manufacturers. And in listening to some of the questions, I think I can give some examples that will help to shed some light on what some of the situations we as equipment dealers end up with. There are times here over the past several years where the equipment industry has had to comply with emissions regulations, and therefore they've had to make several changes in their engines. There is a Tier 4i, which is a designation for a series of engines that met certain emissions requirements. During the Tier 4i period, there were several manufacturers that were not immune to product quality issues. During some of those issues when a specific machine would be having problems, we as an equipment dealer would get a call from our customer and say, this machine here is in barrel. It is having problems with the emissions control system. We need some help to get it up and going. So we would send what information we had to the manufacturer, tell them what symptoms the machine was having, and respond. At times they'd give us some ideas on what to look at, what parts to replace. Other times may not hear anything back, so we'd go up there, send our dispatcher technician up there. Upon arriving there, they may take a look at the machine, find that there's a certain component of the emissions control system which wasn't functioning properly. They had that part, they change it. If not, they take that part and they return to our branch. Then hold on to that part. We now have to fly back out to Barrow with the correct part, replace it, get our customer up and running, and they go forth. The situation where we have issues with reimbursement would come in, where the manufacturer says, okay, for that part, that replacement, we're only offering 3 hours to replace that part, and we don't pay travel time. Well, that means as an equipment dealer, either we or our customers are paying for both those flights to Barrow, the room and board, because the mechanic may not have been able to get out of Barrow due to a flight schedule. Additionally, because it's 20 below outside, this repair that may take 3 hours when you're in California and it's 80 degrees at 20, 30 below may take 6 hours, and you don't have a shop there to do this in. So those additional labor hours that we end up paying, or our cost on those, we don't get reimbursed for on those. And that is a situation where we are looking for some relief on, as well as our customers as well. And that, so that being one situation that I can, if there's other questions that about specific, about other types of situations, I can answer those. But what typically happens in our industry is manufacturers, when they come to their warranties on specific parts or campaigns or updates, they come out with a cookie-cutter approach that allows them to say there's 4 hours of labor and maybe 1 hour or no reimbursement for travel time. And those programs may work in many many other states, but in Alaska, due to the vast remoteness and geographical nature of our state, they just do not work well. Additionally, over the change from the emissions control issues, those engines are all controlled now electronically. At times, there are software updates that a manufacturer may require for these engines. Well, those software updates also have to be done by flying to the machines or driving to them, wherever they may be, and performing those updates. The real issue becomes is when those machines that are off the road system, or say if you're in Fairbanks, even the machines that are in Coldfoot, you're looking at possibly in a service truck, a four-hour drive up there on a service truck to perform something that may only take 30 minutes to 20 minutes for the software update. You have your return trip back. That mechanic's gone for that whole day, but the manufacturer on the software update may only allow a half hour of labor for reimbursement or an hour for reimbursement. There's another example there for one of the situations that we have run into. And can I answer any questions?
Any questions? Thanks again, Mr. Gerundale. Is anybody else online? Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Please join us and state your name and affiliation for the record.
Actually, no, I'm wrong.
Nope. Anybody else? Seeing and hearing none, we will close public testimony. Bring back committee for discussion. We still have Ed Steppen online, I believe. If anybody has any questions for Ed, we've got the sponsors. We actually have the sponsor in the room. We give Julie a promotion. Any questions for anybody? Any discussion? What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move CSHB 67-29-LS0129-E from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any opposition to moving the bill out of committee? Seeing none and hearing none, House Bill 67 as amended with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations is moved out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. It's 4:20. The next item and the last item on the calendar today is House Bill 67. With us, we have Cynthia Franklin, the Executive Director of the ABC, and we've got Michaela Fowler, the Legislative Liaison. On Monday, I believe we heard the bill, and at that point in time, there were some questions about the fiscal notes, and I believe we have one fiscal note that has been revised and provided to the committee, and another one that has not been revised but has a memo from OIH stating that they will not be revising. So the first fiscal note on that one is still valid. So what can you tell us about the fiscal note, Michaela?
All right. Thank you, committee. My name is Michaela Fowler. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Commerce. And during our prior hearing on HB 123, we discussed moving the funds out of the governor's fiscal year 16 budget line on our fiscal note and into the fiscal year 2016 appropriation request. In the House version of the budget, the funds in the governor's request have been removed. And so it seemed appropriate on the House side to move those to our requested funds. Our appropriations are spelled out, and Cindy Franklin will walk you through the specifics of how the fiscal note breaks down. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. House Bill 123 creates a marijuana control board housed within or sharing agency director and staff with the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. The personnel services section of the bill speaks to the addition of four full-time employees to the agency in fiscal year 16. When you look at the narrative section of the fiscal note, you see that there are actually contemplated six added positions to the agency in response to and for the implementation of the regulations related to marijuana in ballot measure 2. Two of the positions were added in fiscal year 15 to respond to the fact that the agency has already had to do substantial work in preparation for regulating this additional substance. So the personal services section of the fiscal note is for the four additional full-time employees. Three of those are investigator positions. One is a business registration examiner position. That's the title given to our licensing specialists. The travel section includes travel for enforcement and compliance travel. Our enforcement officers travel this state to licensees under our alcoholic beverage control model, check that licensees are in compliance with the rules and not providing alcohol to minors. We would anticipate a similar need for travel for marijuana licensees. And there's travel included for the new board. The new board is a 5-member volunteer board set up in a similar fashion to the current Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. And the costs for that board were anticipated in the first year potentially for more meetings given the number and amount of regulations that that board is going to have to oversee at the beginning. So that cost was estimated at a maximum of $50,000 for the fiscal year 16. Then the services section includes our legal services, employee support costs, vehicles for those enforcement officers, printing and public notices, which we do for all of our meetings. We anticipate additional legal services at the beginning, again, because of the need for sort of the massive number of regulations right here at the front end of implementation. And then a database, because we know from our colleagues in Washington and Colorado that there is going to be a great deal of interest in data around the regulation of recreational marijuana. And currently the agency is a paper-based agency. The databases that are employed in other legalized recreational marijuana states include software that tracks marijuana from seed to sale. So the services cost includes the initial cost of enacting a database and similar software, and then maintenance and development of that in the out-year estimates. The commodities section includes the cost of moving the staff, because the location where we're currently housed in the General Services Overflow Warehouse on Viking Drive in Anchorage does not have enough of space to add even the additional two FY15 employees. So that is the breakdown of the fiscal note in the narrative section.
And through the chair, Michaela Fowler, Department of Commerce. I'd also like to add that we do have included in this fiscal note our supplemental costs, and there are some details about what those supplemental costs in the fiscal note, including the expedited regulation timeframe, and also that first round of staff. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Franklin? Representative Liddell.
It looks like the cost of moving the offices is going to be more than the actual staff costs. I mean, you've got commodities. Are you counting, is commodities under the move?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, the commodities includes equipment and office space costs, lease costs, furniture, new employee setup, moving expenses, and equipment purchases. So one-time setup costs are not included after the first year. If you look at the costs you see in the FY16, the commodities is 134.5, and in the out years, 106.1. The difference between 134.5 and 106.1 is the cost of the move.
Okay, I must not have the new fiscal note, because I'm looking at something that doesn't have anything beyond fiscal year.
You'll have one in about 10 seconds.
Okay. All right.
5 seconds.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I would do the math for you, but it's not my strong suit. So
I think I'm following this now. So can I just ask another question?
Certainly.
I guess I'm wondering what the rationale is for the board composition and the rules about the board composition being different for the marijuana industry than they are for the alcohol industry. Why wouldn't you do the two boards pretty basically just the same?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the proposed composition of the Marijuana Control Board is modeled after the proposed revised composition of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. So the work that the stakeholders group did included some substantial and controversial work around making sure that the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board was representative of not only the industry that it regulates, but also the public safety and public health sectors that are affected by that substance. So that work is reflected in the Title IV revisions that have not yet been introduced in this legislative session, but this language in this Marijuana Control Board is modeled after those revisions.
So assuming that those revisions are introduced and assuming that they go through both bodies, we're going to have pretty similar looking boards?
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Franklin, the budget that moved out of finance today, House Finance, has no money for marijuana regulation of any kind. Is that your understanding?
The chair, Representative Josephson, that is my understanding.
Okay.
It was removed.
A follow-up? So this $1.57 million would be, if the statute passes, this would be an addition, just like all other, well, some other fiscal notes, to state spending at the end of the year. At the end of the session.
I'm going to pump that one, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Yes, we were asked by our House Finance Subcommittee to include all costs for regulating marijuana, which means all costs associated with the initiative that passed, in our fiscal note for this bill, rather than asking for them in our budget request.
Okay, and finally, if I may, thank you. These out years, does this reflect then that it won't be in the base or that it is in the base? In other words, do you have to come back every year and ask for $1.4 million? Or is the presumption that you have $1.4 million?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if this bill passed with this fiscal note, then we would not have to come back in those out years. It would go into the base.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Ledoux.
Just wondering how the annual amount for the out-year cost compares to the annual amount for the ABC board, if it's similar. And then also, as you were thinking about the additional positions, investigators, the different, I think it was six, did you solely base that on what the staffing of the ABC board, or did you look at the count of businesses or inquiries for businesses? And I'm wondering if they're going to end up being more marijuana businesses right than there are alcohol related businesses.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there are currently 1,875 alcohol licenses that are overseen by board and board staff and on the alcohol side. The original estimate of the cost of implementation for ballot measure 2 was a mirror image of the staff of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. So we currently, for instance, have 5 investigators statewide, 3 licensing employees, and 2 administrative employees. The estimate was trimmed by me when I took this office in September working on the budget on the assumption that at least in fiscal year 16 we won't have as many marijuana licenses as we have alcohol licenses. No decisions have been made yet in terms of whether or not there will be population limitations on marijuana licenses, similar to the way we have a limited number of alcohol licenses in the state. So in the end, as you move into the out years, there's the potential, there's certainly the potential for the need for additional staff as this industry moves forward. However, it's difficult to estimate until the rules are written and we know how restricted or open the industry might be and what the level of interest is, because it is a new industry to the state.
I'm just curious whether, based on the number of inquiries your office has been getting and what happened in, for instance, in Colorado, and the inquiries and then ultimately the number of businesses that opened up, has there been any comparison?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, yes, I've actually done a pretty extensive comparison of the number of employees and related it to the population levels in the other recreational states. And the closest, I think, analogy for us population-wise is the city of Denver, which issues its own marijuana licenses. They have some employees that are very different and would not be necessary at the state level for regulations such as firemen. But they did anticipate at the beginning of the year, their first year of issuing recreational licenses, that they would need an additional 16 employees. They came back mid-year and asked for 21 more. So they ended up adding in a total of 37.5 full-time employees. The population of the city of Denver is 650,000. They have approximately 900 marijuana licenses in that city right now. So when you look at the types of employees that the city of Denver has that are comparable to the types of employees that our state agency has, I think that depending on the licensing selection process and how those regulations play out, there could be a need and a fairly urgent need in future years for additional staffing. But one thing that we do know from Denver is that all of those positions were fully funded by the city's tax revenues on the substance. So the city took in a little over $6 million in tax revenue in calendar year 2014, and those 37.5 full-time employees cost the city about $4.5 million. So they ended up fully covering their costs with tax revenue. My thought is that as we move forward with establishing the industry, that when the tax revenue becomes apparent, it may be easier to ask for appropriate staffing.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So a couple of questions, and you actually already answered one of them about the tax revenue versus the outlay. But I was just wondering whether or not you had discussed or know how many, since Denver has similar population, and they must have something equivalent to their ABC board. And we do it with, did you say five or six people on the ABC board?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, we have 10 employees statewide, 5 enforcement officers. The state of Colorado does not have a board that regulates marijuana. They regulate marijuana through their Division of Revenue. So revenue does marijuana, alcohol, and gaming. Their marijuana enforcement division employs 55 full-time employees. About half of those are investigators. They split their investigators into compliance and
So I'm wondering, though, how many alcohol people they have, because maybe they do it differently there. So we're able to get along with, I think you said five, maybe you said six people for the ABC board. And then you were talking about how many people it took to regulate marijuana in Colorado. Right. And so I'm asking you, how many people does it take to regulate alcohol in Colorado, to kind of see whether they're doing things more efficiently or less efficiently? So that was kind of where I was coming from.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I don't have the comparison numbers for alcohol in Colorado. I do in Washington. I looked at Washington, and Washington's structure is closer to ours. They have a liquor control board, and they regulate both marijuana and alcohol. And Washington's Alcohol Control Agency has, or at the alcohol side of the Washington Alcohol Control Agency, has 297 employees statewide, and I got, and they anticipate adding about, they've about 120 people, I believe, are working on the marijuana. So it's similar in the sense that they have 15,000 alcohol licenses in Washington, and they have many more people working on the alcohol side of the equation than the marijuana side of the equation, where they have fewer licenses. And when I looked at that and I tried to compare a population-wise to us, I feel that that's really where that 10 versus 6. We have 10 working on alcohol, and we're potentially adding 6 between FY15 and FY16. Is a fairly even comparison there to
Thank
what
you.
Happened
that,
in
that,
Washington.
That answers my question. Okay.
Ms. Franklin, if you can get that information to Conrad, we'll post it on our site and get it out to the members for their review as well. Any further questions for Representative Culver, followed by Representative Kito?
Thank you. Director, I'm just curious about the timing of when the regulations will be starting to be drafted. Obviously, it's going to be quite a long process over the next probably year and a half. Obviously, when session's out and we have a statutory framework, vice chairing the reg review committee, so I imagine we'll be quite involved in looking at the regulatory regime that was recommended by the department.
Representative Culver, through the chair, the initiative gives us 9 months from February 24th to get regulations approved by the board, whether it's the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board or a Marijuana Control Board. So the process of drafting those regulations will begin, as you say, as soon as the session is over and we have the statutory framework. We anticipate that we've had a lot of help from Colorado already and offer of help from Washington, and of course we have Title IV, which we are intimately familiar with as the statutory and regulatory scheme for alcohol. So we have quite a few good starting places, and the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board did release a preliminary considerations document after our trip to Colorado, and with many of the concerns for regulation that the board has already identified. I feel we have a good start, and we're going to get started immediately.
Thank you. Quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. What are your concepts at this point of what, if you were to define in regulation, what public place? If you don't have to answer it, if you don't have anything, but that seems to be a topic that is being batted around the committee rooms quite frequently and in local government as well. Thank you.
Well, Representative Culver, through the chair, the ABC board met in an emergency meeting on February 24th and defined public place using the definition from Title 11, 1181, 900, Section 53. So it gave it the same definition that the term defined the term in public in 1738-040. The prohibition of consumption of marijuana in public, define that term in public with the same definition that is attached to the term public place in Title 11. And there is currently a board meeting set on April 9th in the Anchorage, Ohio, to take public testimony on making that regulation permanent. We did receive some feedback in terms of that definition potentially shutting down the possibility of a business, because it does contain the term business, ever having the possibility of having a cannabis cafe, for instance, where a business could invite members of the public in to smoke marijuana together. The board's position has been that given the overlay of smoking prohibitions in many of our communities in Alaska, that the businesses that would cater to individuals coming together to consume marijuana is sort of a second-year consideration. There are a lot of baseline rules that the board wants to see in place before we go to something that's, you know, whether or not there are going to be those types of businesses. Both other states, Washington and Colorado, have struggled somewhat with that, and both started from the position of not having those types of businesses in their initial regulations.
Thank you.
Representative Kito.
Thank you. I'm trying to get my mind around this. So one of the comments that I've heard made was part of the idea is to regulate marijuana like alcohol, but I think we have some significant differences in the way the businesses would operate. So I think in marijuana we're going to have production, manufacturing, testing, and sales types of businesses. We do have sales types of businesses in alcohol, but we also have as you were just mentioning, the consume in place, which you're not anticipating having. What we also don't have right now are statutes that govern what those four types of businesses are going to look like. And one of the things I am curious about, and maybe you have some comments, is we've got a board structure in place that's meant to regulate the licensing of these businesses. At this point, we don't know what these businesses really are going to look like, and at least in the first year, we're going to be spending most of the time trying to identify regulations, create regulations for the operations of these businesses. I do have a concern that there aren't expertise identified in the board for that startup time when we're actually going to be generating a whole bunch of new regulations that are going to be governing operations of businesses, and we don't have statutes to know what we're going to have to regulate at this point. So I think it's kind of a two-part question. One is, can we really identify who's supposed to be on this board not knowing what the statutes look like? And then, do we need to have a transition so we can have expertise for people that are on the board to assist in developing regulations that are going to allow for the effective operation of the businesses?
Representative Kito, through the chair. The ballot measure itself, 1738-110, that gives the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board regulatory authority unless a separate board is created, does outline the four types of licenses that you have discussed and identified: manufacturing or cultivating, processing, retail, and testing facilities. So there is a sketchy outline contained in 1738 as to those four types of licenses. Regarding composition of the board and representation of any of those types of businesses on the board initially, we know from Title IV that manufacturing is kept out of the alcohol industry representation on the board, and there's a specific reason for that that has to do with the way alcohol regulation developed over the years in a tiered system. It is unknown at this time whether or not there will be a similar tiered system in marijuana, and as you say, the differences between the two substances makes it unlikely that that there would, in fact, we have not written in to House Bill 123 any prohibition on the tier of the industry that the industry representation would come from. So theoretically, these industry representatives contained in House Bill 123 could be representatives of any of those four types of licensees. I believe it will be a challenge at first because it is not an existing industry to identify industry representation for the board. However, we have not had a shortage of people coming forward wanting to be part of the board. The gubernatorial appointment system, that vetting system, would enable some evaluation of whether or not a person who put themselves forward as a part of the industry. And it's very difficult, right, because right now the industry is illegal, but and whether or not someone would put themselves forward as an experienced grower, we have seen some confidence from the public and from people that have approached the board since November that the voters' will is going to be honored and that people can openly speak about their experience growing this substance. We've had many approach me who have told me they've been growing this substance for for over 40 years, and we've seen them appear at more local government committee meetings, a growers association in the Mat-Su Valley, appearing at a meeting on marijuana in the Mat-Su. And so I do believe that we'll be able to identify in the short term people who claim to be part of the industry, but we sort of have to get an industry going before we know for sure that they are. I think that the transition sections of the bill, together with the staggered terms, would enable the governor to appoint someone into one of the shorter term positions that's going to turn over, for instance, the 1 year a term, so that if it turned out that a person who represented that they were part of the industry didn't end up being part of the industry, that the governor could turn that seat on the board over to someone who by the end of that first year was an identified representative of the industry. And I know that we've spoken before about the fact that people who supported the ballot measure, for instance, or who were with a coalition for responsible cannabis legislation might not necessarily be industry representatives in that they are business people. But I believe that the gubernatorial board selection process is good at identifying that business background. And so I have had quite a few business people contact me and say, we want to get into this industry. And I think that someone like that, who is a long business background and who has expressed interest in getting into the industry, might be appropriate for one of the shorter term appointments at the beginning.
Paula? Thank you. And I think that does help a little bit. I think the desire of the administration, though, doesn't give me a lot of confidence that we will end up with people that have good business experience. And we do have a public health and a public safety representative, a rural and general public representative, two industry representatives, but the industry representatives don't in statute have to have any business experience because we don't have a business or an industry in Alaska. And I just am concerned that we could end up without anybody with substantial business experience putting together regulations that are going to be regulating all of the types of businesses that are going to be having anything to do with marijuana. And so I'm thinking about this a lot. I'm trying to figure out how we make sure it's successful and it works. I do have concerns with kind of the way it's structured at this point. But thank you.
Well, I'll put everybody at ease. The bill's not moving today. There's a lot more work that needs to be done. I think several other members have already approached me asking me what my intentions were, and that's to get it done right the first time, as near as we can. Representative Ladue, did you have another question, or did I?
I think I did, but I've forgotten what it was.
So, if there are no further questions, I'm going to try to get a little bit of public testimony, and I don't believe I'm going to be closing out public testimony today either, but... public testimony is open. How about James Barrett? Please identify yourself on record and please limit yourself to 3 minutes. We've got a number of people we're going to try to get to, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. My name is James Barrett. I live here in Juneau, Alaska. Looking into getting into this industry, learning a lot about it like everyone else is right now. I appreciate all of your time on trying to learn this stuff. I know, like, when you were voted to be a legislator, this wasn't probably on the list at that moment. We all know that. But now it is. Alaska, we got this awesome opportunity to create an awesome industry here, just like we did with fishing. That's kind of how we became a state, right? So I think with the fishing that already existed before we got into it, it's the same with the marijuana. We just call it a black market. Doesn't sound very good, but it exists already. With a separate marijuana control board, I see that we can get a lot more expert opinion onto the board. It organizes it outside of alcohol because we can recognize the fact that they aren't the same, but they can be regulated similarly. So I'm in support of this bill. I think Cynthia Franklin is very intelligent. Everyone that I've met with in this state so far that's paid to be doing this, I have yet to meet someone as informed about the industry as her. If she says marijuana control board, and I also support the governor's request for this, I believe is where it's coming from, I think it's a really good idea. And I think that it allows these little variances in the industry of marijuana that are different from alcohol to take place, and that way we can create an industry the right way the first time without having to do this like Title IV back and forth stuff with alcohol. We can separate them right away and then have the industry regulate from that. So that's all I have. If you have any questions, I can answer them.
No, I got one statement. I'd rather have my job than Ms. Franklin's. I think she's doing an incredible job with something that was pretty well handed to her unexpectedly, I guess. But thanks again for joining us today. Next up, how about Ellen Gamley from Fairbanks?
Hello, I'm Ellen Gamley, and I live in Fairbanks, and I'm a member of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. I know there's been a lot of discussion about whether it would be better to have one board or two. And I have to admit, when in November, I was thinking in along the lines of one board, but you know, looking at the amount of work that that board will be doing, plus and adding that to what we've got on our plate, you know, the 1,800 plus licenses. We've just spent 3 years rewriting Title IV, and there'll be a lot of time spent on implementation of that. It just seems to make sense to me that it should be two boards. And that's basically all I had.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Let's see. Kim Cole, Anchorage, LIO. They're off, Matt, I'm sorry. Are you with us, Kim?
Yes, I am. My name is Kim Cole, and I'm from Anchorage, and I'm calling in to support this bill to create a separate marijuana control board under the direction of Cynthia Franklin, and who has absolutely proven her drive and desire to make this work. This makes sense for many reasons, financially as well as in terms of who is creating the regulations for this industry. And the one thing that I would like to point out is that the bill states that there can be up to two individuals representing the cannabis industry. I would like to suggest that we really need to make sure that there are two people, not one, from the industry, because it is so incredibly far-reaching. There are cultivators, processors of non-consumables like concentrates and lotions, as well as the processors of consumable edible products. And then we'll also have to have places to purchase these substances, such as in retail stores. Potentially, we've talked about registrations for special events like cannabis cups, beer gardens, cafes, and things like that. And the point being that no one person can know everything there is to know about all aspects of the cannabis industry because it is so broad. So it's really imperative to have two representatives on the board in order to try and cover all of these bases. And I appreciate the idea that people have to have a business background in order to be on the board, and there should be business people on it, but I also don't think that it's imperative to have somebody with only a business background, and that it's really important to have an array of backgrounds that are represented who are really passionate about this industry. And thank you for your time and for the opportunity to testify today.
Well, thank you for participating with us. Let's see, how about Frank Berardi, Fairbanks?
Hello, my name is Frank Berardi. I'm the chairman of the board for the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation. Our group would like to express our support for HB 123. We would like to see a separate autonomous marijuana control board housed under the same framework as the alcohol control board and directed by Cynthia Franklin. Just a comment on the vetting process for industry representatives. We believe that our coalition and a few other groups around the state have people who do have extensive business experience, and several of us have educations in business and have completed business plans for this venture. So we'd like to see that be an open process for many people to be able to apply and have them vetted for the position. And I personally support having a one-year term for the first industry representatives just to see how this thing shakes out. But overall, we really do support House Bill 123, and we hope that that's how things work out. Thank you.
Thank you again. Gianno Barrett? Thanks again for joining us today.
My name is Gianno Barrett. I live here in Juneau, Alaska. And I'm I support House Bill 123. I think it's a great idea to put regulation in the hands of the Alcohol Control Board, and I think that Cynthia Franklin and her staff have done a great job and have been a breeze to listen to as somebody that I'm looking to get into the industry myself, and I've been a long-time marijuana user and a medical marijuana register as well. And there's a lot of information about marijuana, and as we know, the key here is education. There's so much to learn. I mean, it can take years. I feel like Cynthia Franklin's covered a lot of information really well, and for somebody who knows the industry from the inside looking to get into it, I think that she's spot on in everything she's been saying, and I would trust her to regulate properly. So I'm in support of 123. Thank you.
Thank you again. Gerard Gall, Fairbanks.
Hello, my name is Gerard Gall. I'm with the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation. I'm just calling in to throw my support behind the Marijuana Control Board as a separate committee working alongside the Alcohol Beverage Control Board under Cynthia Franklin. I want to thank you very much for all your support and hard work on this bill. HB 123 looks great. Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, we're the committee that doesn't have any props. The other committees have had props, but thanks again for joining us today. Bruce Schulte.
Chairman Olson, good afternoon. My name is Bruce Schulte. I'm also with the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation, calling today from Anchorage. I will just say, if you want to show and tell, we can definitely set you up there. I too want to speak in favor of House Bill 123. Historically, our group had been advocating for a separate marijuana control board, but we do think that given the combined constraints of schedule and budget, the combined board, or the hybrid board as some of us refer to it, would be a terrific solution, and I also have tremendous faith in Cynthia Franklin's ability to guide both of these boards. I would just like to point out two things. Well, I would like to echo what Kim said about representation on the board. The bill does say no more than two marijuana industry representatives, and I would just echo her sentiment that we would really hope to see two on there, not just one. And also, I just wanted to emphasize the fact that the schedule has actually begun on this regulatory process. It kicked off February 24th, and that board, whenever it does form, has until November 24th. So I would suggest that this has become the critical path in this process, and anything that we can do to help along, we will certainly do, and we support this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you again for joining us today and participating. Brandon Emmett. Delta, off net.
Hello?
Are you with us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, perfect. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. My name is Brandon Emmett. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation, and I am here today to thank the House Rules Committee for bringing forward House Bill number 123. I think it's a step in the right direction. As Bruce had just stated, our original position was that we wanted a completely autonomous marijuana control board, but with the given constraints, we feel that a hybrid board housed under the offices of the the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board can get the rules put in place in a timely fashion. And it is important that there is a separate number of board members for regulation of marijuana, because these individuals can A, know the industry, and B, be unfettered by any sort of conflicts of interest that someone who is directly involved in the alcohol industry may have. And that's all the comments I have on this for today, and I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you again for joining us. Is there anybody else online? Yeah, I don't think. With that, we're going to hold public testimony open, and we will adjourn at 5 minutes to 5:00.